You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And part of the American way has been striking when you're screwed by your employer. Look at what's going on in Michigan right now. I mean, this is not so much the strike as the protest. That's also part of America. In fact, we were born in protest. You know, the Boston Tea Party in the fall of 1773. It was the first protest against transnational corporations. Arguably, that was the pressure, that pushing back, that birthing of our nation in a protest. I was going to say a riot, but it was quiet. In fact, George Robert Twelvetree Hughes, who was the only person there who actually wrote an account of it, said it was the quietest night Boston had seen in years because they worked in silence, these guys, when they busted open the chests and threw the tea in the harbor. But anyhow, we were birthed in protest, and I would say for the first 20, 30, 40 years of this nation's history, the reason why we didn't have plutocrats, and we didn't, I mentioned to you, I've been reading Krista Freeland's book, Plutocrats, which is just brilliant. And in her first chapter, she adds a lot of documentation to a summary that I have in What Would Jefferson Do?, my book, which points out that basically even the richest of the so-called rich white guys who started this country were paupers compared to the rich in Europe. And that the first 30 years of American history was the time in this country's history. Now, this was after the Revolution when the genuinely rich people fled the country, went to Canada or to the UK, was the most egalitarian time in the history of this country. The difference between rich and poor was smaller from the 1780s until the 1820s than ever before, or ever since. So anyhow, in that spirit, and in the spirit of the great Flint sit-down strike of 1935 and all the labor efforts that have gone on, 10,000 workers converged on the Michigan State Capitol today for the latest labor battle in what's been a three-decades-long losing war for labor rights in America. And with their backs now against the wall, Michigan unions face annihilation and the subsequent annihilation of organized labor across America, or redemption. It's largely through unions that working Americans get living wages, the 40-hour work week, benefits, pensions, so that they can raise a family, they can reach the American dream, retire comfortably. The middle class was built by organized labor. But today the unions are dying. It was disconcerting back in February this year when Indiana transformed into a right-to-work-for-less state, a sign that the union busters had moved into the nation's Rust Belt, where organized labor was born. And it's downright frightening now that Michigan, the home of the powerful auto unions, has suffered, or looks like it's suffering, the same fate. And just consider this. I mean, you know, here's some stats for you. Michigan is the fifth most unionized state in the nation. Nearly one-third of all the voters living in Michigan live in union households. But here's the problem. Michigan's labor community is just made up of average working people. Even the labor bosses, union bosses, are basically average working people who got elected by their peers to the position of being a labor boss, president of the union kind of thing. But Dick DeVos and the Koch brothers, these guys have a fortune. I mean, the Koch brothers alone laundered over $900,000 through the Republican Governors Association to get Rick Snyder elected in Michigan. And so using that as leverage, they forced Rick Snyder to renege on earlier promises that he had made to his state when he was running for election and even afterward when he was testifying under oath before Congress. And he said, oh, no, we're not going to do right to work for less. He turned his back on working people. He threw his support behind Michigan becoming the 24th right to work for less state in America. Talk about the rise of the Confederacy. So now workers in Michigan can expect lower wages, minimal benefits, more deadly workplace accidents, all that stuff that comes with right to work for less laws, wherever they pop up. And the labor unions in Michigan will watch helplessly if this law stands. as critical revenue dries up, because basically what right to work for less laws say is if you work in a union shop and therefore you get the benefits of the contract that the union negotiated for you, you get the good paycheck, you get the union representing you in disputes, you get the good benefits, you get the decent pension, you get whatever it may be, you get all that stuff that the union made happen. If you live in a free bargaining state, the other 27 states, then and a majority, more than 50% of you and your peers have voted to have a union in your workplace. In other words, democratically you've chosen to have a union, then everybody who benefits from the union has to pay union dues. But in a right to work for less state, this is the beginning and end of what right to work for less is all about. This is it. In a right to work for less, and this is why people like Rick Snyder, you know, lie about this stuff and call it choice. It's worker choice. In a right to work for less state, if you're a member of the union and you're getting all those benefits of the union, you don't have to pay the dues if you don't want to. You are voluntarily asked to pay your union dues. And the result of that is that, you know, there's some people who say, hey, you know, I'm going to pay my union dues no matter what. I was working at Clear Channel in Portland when we were a union shop at KPOJ. And we were represented by AFTRA. And, you know, that Clear Channel group had a right-wing station and a left-wing station and a bunch of music stations. And they held a vote and they decertified the union. They said, we're not going to be a union shop anymore. And I went down to HR and I said, keep taking the union dues out of my paycheck. I'm going to continue to be a member of the union, even if this group is not. And I am to this day. But, you know, so there's going to be some people who are going to say, yeah, I want to continue paying my union dues. But there's also going to be some people going, hey, you know, I could take an extra $20 a week or whatever it is. You know, it'll be for somebody, it'll be $10 a week. Or for somebody else, it'll be, you know, 50 or 100, or it depends on how much money they're making. But hey, I could take a little extra. You know, it's called being a freeloader. The right to work for less laws really should be called the union freeloader laws, or the freeload on the union, or the screw your union laws. So, you know, the Koch strategy can be summed up in one sentence. Here it is. If we can make this happen in Michigan, then we can make it happen in any state of the union. And given what's happened to organized labor all over America ever since the Reagan presidency, the takedown of Michigan may just signal the beginning to the end of labor unions as we know them. And that would be a disaster for America. You know, we can't ever write off the power of organized working people. But the trends are pretty hard to ignore. I mean, starting in the 60s, union representation began to decline. This was the result of Taft-Hartley. But it really crashed after Reagan moved into the White House and busted up PATCO in 81. A third of the American workforce was unionized 40 years ago. Today, it's just above a tenth. And if you're looking at private sector unions, less than 7%. So the corporatists and the conservatives, they're now smelling blood. And they have put the last remaining strongholds of organized labor, a.k.a. Michigan, my home state, into their crosshairs. I mean, they went after them in Wisconsin, and they went after them in Ohio, and they lost. But unionized cops and firefighters, they're losing their jobs thanks to conservative austerity policies at the state level. In Camden, New Jersey, the most dangerous city in America, the entire unionized police force is getting pink slips. They're going to be replaced by scabs. Teachers' unions under assault. Postal Service, they want to break that up. It's the largest unionized employer in America. I mean, there's a genuine war on working people going on here, and Michigan right now is ground zero.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And working people know it. So if you're, you know, if you're near Lansing, get thee to Lansing, Michigan right now.
Well, it's been down on the union and was made in the USA. Sure was a good idea if we got in the way.
There you go, Bob Dylan. Indeed. Okay, two quick thoughts, and I'm going to pick up some of your phone calls here on this topic. Number one, I think it's possible. I'm actually optimistic. I think it's possible that Rick Snyder's behavior in Michigan, which he clearly didn't want to do. I mean, he went to Congress and testified under oath that he had no plans to turn Michigan into a right-to-work-for-less state. And I don't think he'd do that if, you know, I just don't think that a guy who's the governor of a state is going to go to Congress and lie. I think he genuinely didn't intend to do this. But the Koch brothers put up over $900,000 for him to get elected. They've laundered that money through the Republican Governors Association. And so when the Koch brothers pull the chain, Todd Akin goes, ha, yes, sir. Excuse me, not Todd Akin, Rick Snyder. Now, the reason I was going to say Todd Akin is because I think this might be a Todd Akin moment for the Republican Party, where they have, you know, Todd Akin was sitting around going, oh, yeah, you know, people don't like abortion, so, and you know, we can, you know, have abortion illegal for even women who've been raped, you know, quack, 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 and, oh, maybe there's a legitimate rape or not, and women, you know, these crackpot opinions. And he blurts this stuff out, and the women of America are going, what? Really? And what was a shoe-in Republican seat got lost. And I think in a very real way, it's entirely possible that what's going on in Michigan right now, where Rick Snyder has been basically browbeaten or bribed or paid off or threatened by the Koch brothers and Dick DeVos and the whole bunch from you know, the Grand Rapids area and the conservative multimillionaires and billionaires of the state, the power brokers, the Republican Party power brokers, is that he may be overreaching. And he may be overreaching so badly that, I mean, the good citizens of Michigan can't do anything about it today. But in 2014, in 2016, you may see Michigan go back to being the Democratic state that it was through, you know, all the years that I lived there. And so, if that's possible, if we're looking at a Todd Akin moment in Michigan, this actually might be really good news, not the horrible bad news that it looks to be. Even if Rick Snyder signs the law and you're stuck with it for 2 years. But that requires everybody remembering what happened, talking about what happened, organizing around about what happened, getting out the vote, waking people up. And most importantly, pushing back. I mean, now the 50,000 watt station out of Detroit. You know, the giant. When I was growing up in Michigan, you could hear, I don't want to say call letters, but you could hear the station all over the state virtually. And you know, they throw a signal into Ohio and probably Indiana and whatnot. But in any case, now it's a conservative talk show, a talk station. And they're all over the state, all these right-wingers all over the state. So there's not a lot of voices talking back. But the union's still there. 1 in 3 voting households in America has a union member in it. And I think that one of the reasons why right to work for less works for conservatives is because basically there are a lot of relatively young people. You know, I mean, by young, I mean old, young enough that they don't remember when the union fought and in some cases died to get the pay and benefits that they have. They might be 40 years old, but they don't remember. Right. And I mean, they weren't there. Union's been around for a long time. And so they get a job at a union shop and they just figure, hey, this is the way it is. Good pay, good benefits, decent vacation. Get my health care paid for, get a week or two off every year, I got a decent paycheck, and they just, you know, they look around and figure, what do I need the union for? And so when the state flips from a free bargaining state to a right to work for less state, and now they're presented with the choice, because this is all that law does, is it says, you no longer have to pay the union dues for the union that you voted in, because it has to be a 51% majority or greater. So literally, you know, democratically, you did, small d, you did vote that Union Inn. You no longer have to pay those dues. You can choose not to and still get the benefits of the union. And so, I mean, it takes money to run a union, not big bucks. I mean, it's not like, you know, Koch Brothers money. But you got to have a lawyer. You got to have lawyers on staff. You got to have people to fight the fight on behalf of people. You've got to have, you know, some sort of management structure. You've got to have a way to interact with the public. You got to have some kind of PR structure. I mean, basically, you know, the union is a democracy in the workplace. And just like any kind of democracy, it's got to have some kind of administration. You know, the federal government wouldn't work if you didn't have Congress and the presidency. I'm still torn about the Supreme Court. But in any case, so you know, these members who don't realize, you know, what the union did for them and haven't seen this long arc of history going back to the Pullman Porters and before, just say, oh, you know, I can save a couple $100 a year if I don't pay my union dues. And I don't have to pay my union dues, so screw it. I'm not going to pay my union dues. And the unions end up, you know, without enough money to operate, and someday that union's gone. Fewer than 7% of American workers are now represented in the private sector by a union. And when that union's gone, guess who's coming right behind the union to be the new major force in the company? Bain Capital. Oh, yeah. This is what happened to Hostess. I mean, it wasn't Bain. It's another company using the same business model. But basically, Vulture Capital. So they're negotiating with 110 different companies to break that company up and sell off its pieces.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So if you're in Michigan, give us a call. Let us know what's going on. And I'm curious if you think that I might be right, that this might be the Todd Akin moment. This might be the overreach by the Republicans nationally.
Why don't they do what they say?
Minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Plain Doomsday Politics, the headline of the Huff Post piece by James Hoffa. This is Doomsday Politics, what they're doing in Michigan right now. We will see how this plays out. Tom, in Rapid City, South Dakota. Hey, Tom, you were a 30-year union member?
Yeah, 30-plus year union member, and at the same time, I actually ran my own local union about a third of that time, and I have quite a bit of experience in a right-to-work state. And one of the things I wanted to mention was that the governor was saying that he thinks that this is good because it gives a choice to the workers. Workers already have a choice. If they don't want to be a union member in a closed-shop state like that, they can refuse to be a member, and they can pay only for the cost of servicing a contract. In other words, the union has to figure out the amount that they have to pay for contract negotiation and agreements and things like that. Right. One of the things I can tell you from having ran a local union in a small state, and at the same time I ran the local union, I also worked in the shop. So, I mean, it was a small union. We actually, the union is required by law to represent those people, whether they're a member or not. And the local union representative can be sued. The union can be sued, and so can the local union representative if they don't adequately represent those people.
Right.
And I had a situation where I had to go to arbitration for a non-dues-paying member and spent several thousand dollars to help that individual. It tremendously does hurt unions when they.
So this was in a right to work for less state.
Correct. A very small union, yes. And again, you're required by law to represent these people, and you will get sued if you don't.
Right. Yeah. No. This is just incredibly. It's not just destructive to the workers. It's not just destructive to the unions. It's destructive to the workers too, because eventually, in a right to work for less state, the union just goes away. And then there's nobody to fight on behalf of the worker, even the worker who didn't want to join the union because they've been listening to Rush Limbaugh or whatever. So, yeah, I got it, Tom. Thank you very much for the call. Well said. Jeremy in Pittsburgh, Michigan, or Petersburg, Michigan. Hey, Jeremy.
Yeah, hi, Tom.
You were at the Capitol?
Yes, I was. Kind of a rough day for Michigan today, but what great support. I mean, you know, thousands and thousands of people, well over 10,000 people, inside and out. Teachers, nurses, firefighters, Teamsters, you name it, they were there. But, you know, still kind of a rough day for Michigan.
Yeah, yeah, at the very least. No evidence that the governor or the legislature are, and in fact, has the governor, it's after 3 in the afternoon now. Has the governor signed the law, do you know?
It sounds like he's going to sign it tomorrow. And the House voted on the public portion of the bill this morning. The vote went 58-52, I believe, with six Republicans voting against, including my local state representative. He's a Republican. He voted against it, fortunately. And the Senate, I still have not heard what the Senate had done with it.
Right.
But, yeah, it sounds like it did make it through both chambers, both the public and private sector parts of it.
Right.
And it sounds like the governor is going to sign it tomorrow. So,
and they're keeping money attached to it.
There'll be a lot more of it there tomorrow.
And they're keeping money attached to it, so it's considered a budget bill, so it can't be
pulled
by public.
In the House this morning, they tried to take out the
appropriations part. Yep. We just lost Jeremy. Sorry about that, Jeremy. Not sure what happened, but yeah. Okay. Thank you, Dave in Chicago. Hey, Dave.
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
Great.
You know, I know you're a devotee of history, but I want to take you way back to prehistoric times. This Republican versus Democrat thing started back then. There were two groups. There were the Neanderthals who pride themselves in being strong, individual, and kind of solitary. And there were the Homo sapiens who, for some reason or another, found that working together in groups benefited them. Going forward, the Neanderthals are gone, nowhere to be found. I liken the Neanderthals to the Republicans and the Homo sapiens to the Democrats who know how to work together. They know that government, for all its ills, is people helping people, working together.
And so are unions. Unions are democratic institutions. Interesting point, Dave. I disagree with your characterization of the Neanderthals, but your point largely is well made. Carlene, and you know, we could have that Neanderthal conversation another time. Carlene in Mason, Michigan. Hey, Carlene.
Hi.
I broke my back in your town. Seriously, there's a little airstrip in Mason, and went skydiving
yes,
there.
I love Mason. We moved back here from Virginia.
Yep.
My husband retired from the Navy after 22 years.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, this whole thing, I was down there earlier today. I grew up, I marched down there for my aunt and for my father, my grandfather, my grandmother, my mother, my sister. Everybody works for a union here.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's what Michigan was built on.
Yep.
As I remember going when we were young, getting our flu shots and going to the dentist that the union paid for and going to the meetings. And my grandfather, even when he retired from the UAW, they still met to discuss things and have their little breakfast stuff and go to the union. And union dues back then were great. I mean, as far everybody paid for them, but we got stuff back in return, and that's how all of Michigan was built.
Yeah.
And I knew this was going to happen. I kept telling people, I voted for Virge Bonaro. I didn't vote for Snyder. I even campaigned for Virge Bonaro.
Yeah, he's a good guy.
And I knew this was going to happen. I said, you cannot trust this man. He's a businessman. He doesn't even live here in Lansing.
Mm.
He lives in Grand Rapids in his big mansion.
Hmm.
And so he has the state patrol taking him back and forth.
Wow.
So, you know, I knew this was
he lives up in DeVos territory.
Oh, yes. He came down and he had a lot of money. And granted, yes, it was on the ballot to about the union, but they twisted it up so much and there was just commercial after commercial after commercial against the union and twisting it about you don't want to change the Constitution and all this other stuff. And I said, and then it didn't pass. And so now he's using that as a referendum over people's heads.
Right.
Is saying, oh, we put it on the ballot and it didn't pass, so I can just go ahead and make it right to work.
Yeah. Yeah. It's crazy. Carlene, thank you for the call. Thanks for showing up today in Lansing. It's good on you. Linda in Deerfield Beach, Florida. Hey, Linda, you grew up in Michigan.
I did. I grew up in Michigan. I went to Roseville High. My husband was Grosse Pointe North. We were there 27 years, both of us, and then we came down to a right-to-work state called Florida.
Oh, my.
And, yes.
Did you notice the difference in the working conditions?
Big, huge, huge, huge. I mean, they have no clue what's about to hit them.
Yeah.
They have no clue. And when we were up there in September telling them, look, you got to start voting some of these guys out. They're going to do damage. They're going to do damage. We know. We live in a right-to-work state. Jeb Bush ruined this state. I mean, absolutely just slaughtered this state with workman's comp laws and and Scott right now has got legislation on his desk that he's ready to sign that says that they don't have to take union dues out of your paycheck anymore. And, you know, nothing is worse, and I'm sorry, Tom, nothing is worse than a union brother who's freeloading.
Yeah.
And you're going to the union meetings, you're trying to inform people, you're paying your union dues, and then you have the freeloader who says, no, by law, you got to represent me. That's what they're up against. It's divide and conquer is what they're trying
to
do.
Absolutely. And this is why they exempt police and fire when they do it so often. So that the political force of the state, or the enforcers of the state, as it were, particularly the police, are still with the power structure. Hey, I got mine. Right to work for less is a divide and conquer within the individual unions, because it says to those people who, some of them out of bad intention, and some of them, frankly, because, the extra, $50 a month is big money to them, are just going to say, no, I'm not going to pay my union dues. I don't have to. I'm not going to. Linda, thank you for the call. Excellent point. Shano shared with me thoughts. Diffusion of responsibility. This is basically what we're talking about. Hey, I can freeload on this. And also this whole idea that, corporate ownership from far away is not that different from drone wars. It's a great metaphor that, that's the Baneization of America. Mark in Harper's Ferry, West Virginia. Just a minute here before we got to take a break. Mark, what's up?
Yeah, Tom. I just want to say, in addition to the financial impact on unions, I think that once the membership of the union drops below 50%, they can actually destroy the union as well.
Yeah, they can decertify it.
Exactly. They can decertify it and have it taken out. So, I mean, obviously, they like the financial impact, but I think their ultimate goal is to do away with the union without a question. I also just like to say I worked for 18 years in a union shop, and I was a union steward for 12 years, so I dealt with a lot of this stuff. So
yeah, this should surprise none of us, and yet it should horrify all of us. And I, if we play this right, if enough people speak out loudly enough, and if progressive voices can just hang on there, stay on the air for the next generation, then this could be the Todd Akin moment. This could be when America wakes up and says, oh.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Now we know what those Republicans are all about. They're all about, well, not us. They're all about the billionaires, and that's it.
When it all amounts to nothing, it's together we don't stand.
Welcome back to the True People's Media, the Tom Hartman Program, and I started this hour by quoting from and referencing James Hoffa's brilliant piece in Huffington Post, Playing Doomsday Politics, and let's wrap the hour with James Hoffa himself, the president of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, Teamster.org, of course, their website. James Hoffa, welcome back to the program.
Tom, it's great to be on.
So what's the latest from Michigan? What's going on there?
Well, I'm on my way back from Lansing. We had, I believe, 50,000 workers there from all different unions to demonstrate our distaste with what's going on. The governor, has taken a lame duck session of the state legislature and rammed through in 5 days a bill of huge importance, this right-to-work bill. He's going to sign it tomorrow. This is really kind of a sneak attack on labor. He didn't permit any testimony, and nor did he have any input from anybody else. Just did it on his own. We really think this has the fingerprints of, the Karl Rove's and the the Koch brothers, because it's very similar to what was done in Wisconsin and Ohio. You know, this is big business flexing its muscles. And he didn't even trust the new legislature. He used the lame duck to jam this through, because we did win, the Democrats won a number of seats in the new House.
Right.
So he wouldn't even let them be seated.
Well, and he had some Republicans.
People are very, very upset with this. It's anti-democratic. It's going to change the dynamic. It's going to set off, you know, a civil war in a very unionized state where people have worked together for many, many years. We have UPS here. We have, you know, General Motors, Ford, Chrysler, all under union contracts. People get along. The state is doing well. The auto industry is recovering. And this is a terrible time to basically set out a very divisive policy.
Yeah, these right to work for less laws are not just destructive to unions, but to workers and workers' rights as a whole. I was born in Michigan. I spent my first 27 years there. It's my home state. And I'm just astounded. I mean, my dad was able to be a member of the middle class, basically. He worked in a tool and die shop for 40 years. He was able to own his house by the time he died. We bought a new car every 2 years, took a vacation every year. He raised four boys and put us through school because he had a union job. And you know, of all the states where I would think everybody gets this, Michigan would be at the top of the list. I'm astounded that Rick Snyder was willing to do this, much less able. Do you think it's possible, James Hoffa, that this could be a Todd Akin moment? That this could, you know, where Todd Akin came out and talked about forcible rape, and all of a sudden the women of America said, "What? Is that really how the Republicans are thinking?" And that this could be the moment when working people around America go, "What? Is that really what's going on?"
I think that it could be. You know, they're talking about, because they had a term up there, he ran as the nerd. So now they have a chant, one-term nerd, one-term nerd.
Yeah.
Which I thought was pretty clever.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, this really changes our, you know, everybody's view of him. Whether you're a Republican or Democrat, why would somebody do this? We tried to work with him, but I really think what this is about is politics. I think this is bigger than, I don't think that the, you know, Dick DeVos, who's a billionaire that runs Amway here in Michigan, I don't think Karl Rove, I don't think the Koch brothers really worry about workers' rights or what they do with unions. This is about basically weakening the Democratic Party. Democratic Party in Michigan is very, very close to labor. And they realize that Obama won this race in Michigan by 9 points. And I think they're dumbfounded by that. And they say only because unions are strong here is the reason why we could not get Romney or sell Romney to the people of Michigan. And Obama won by such a large margin. So I do think that this is a plan to weaken the Democratic Party. And how do you weaken the Democratic Party? Weaken labor. And I think that's what's going on here. I think this is a lot bigger than what it looks like. I mean, obviously, this is a big issue for us, but I think that's the reasoning of why they did it. And that's a question. The consequences are going to be unbelievably divisive. But now we've got to look at, what do we do? This is happening. For whatever reason, it is happening.
Yeah.
And what we've got to do is to figure out, how do we go to court? How do we get this on the ballot somehow in a referendum? That's got to be our goal, and I think that's what we're talking about right now, after the dust settles. People should know that this law doesn't take effect for 90 days. So, you know, not that that's good or bad, but that is something. There is a, we got to sit down and figure out what our strategy is. But I think this has been a real Pearl Harbor, because, you know, when Rick Snyder ran, he always said, "Oh, it's not on my agenda, not on my agenda." People would ask him. And then all of a sudden, in the lame duck session, right after Romney got beat, they do this. You have to put two and two together and say this is part of a bigger picture. This is about power politics, 2014, 2016.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think, you know, another small factor in that might be that the Michigan Constitution says that any law that goes into place, unless there's a supermajority that puts it into immediate effect, doesn't go into effect until the next legislative session. Or the next year. So maybe by sneaking it in before the year.
Yeah, I've read that 90. I got a memo on that, so that's what I'm hearing. So.
Yeah, so well, by doing it this year, it'll go into effect next year, which is like, you know, in 3 weeks. So, or not into effect. I mean, it could be going into effect in 90 days. But my point is, otherwise, if they did it in January, it could take an entire year before it goes into effect. And so this might be a way of sneaking it into effect faster, too. But I think
the word is he's going to sign it tomorrow.
Yeah, incredible. Incredible. I think this has to do with the $900,000 that the Koch brothers laundered through the Republican Governors Association to help get Rick Snyder elected.
Well, that's what I believe. And also, they're promising support in 2014 when he runs. They're already lining him up, telling him, you want support, you have to do this. I believe that's what's going on.
How is that not bribery?
That there is a lot more to politics than meets the eye. When people do things that he said he wasn't going to do, I think that they had to have a meeting somewhere, and they said, look, if you want the support, the big money that we're going to put out, then you better do this, because this is what we want.
Yeah, this is the payback for a purchased election. Amazing. James P. Hoffa, the president of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, teamster.org, of course, the website. James, it's always a pleasure having you on the program. Thanks for dropping by today.
Thank you.
Good speaking with you. President Hoffa, I should address you correctly. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, not only are the Republicans going after the unions, which we were talking about in the last hour, we will continue to talk about throughout the program. But, you know, the low-hanging fruit, welfare recipients. This is one of the reasons why there's so much talk on the right about let's means test Social Security or Medicare. In other words, if you make a certain amount of money as an old person, you know, income from investments or whatever, you're no longer eligible for Social Security and Medicare. Why? To turn them into welfare programs. Because once something's a welfare program, hey, then you can slap those people upside the head, because welfare recipients are our national whipping boys, as it were. And now Ohio says, yeah, if you want welfare money, pee in the cup. Jamie Weinstein is with us, senior editor with The Daily Caller. The Daily Caller, it's dailycaller.com. He's also the author of The Lizard King, and he's got his latest piece in The Daily Caller is New York Times Cairo Bureau Chief, Muslim Brotherhood, Moderate, Regular, Old Political Force. I suspect there's a lot buried in that. Jamie, welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
Yeah, thanks for joining us. So in Florida, we've seen this movie before. You know, in Florida, they had mandatory drug testing for cash benefit recipients in that state. There are 4,100 of them, roughly, statewide in the entire state. And 108 of them failed the test, which means in the neighborhood of 4,000 of them passed the test. And the 108 who failed the test, almost all of them were for pot use, which could have been just they walked through a room where somebody was smoking, the way those tests work. But in any case, Florida, you have to reimburse somebody who passes the test for the $30 cost of the test. So the state had to reimburse $118,140, which cost the state $45,780 more than the benefits that they told people they couldn't get because they'd failed the drug test. Clearly, this does not pass the is this good public policy or does this make fiscal sense classical so-called conservative test. It looks to me like this is punishment.
Tom, that may be very well the case. My argument is not that it should be instituted everywhere. I merely think that if it was cost effective, which there are, as you mentioned, examples where it was not cost effective, but if it is cost effective, the state should have the prerogative to do it, but I don't see anything that's outlandish about it.
What's outlandish about it, Jamie. Sure. There's a stigma associated with being drug tested. Can you imagine the response in this town if the federal government passed a law that said that anybody who goes on television or radio has to be drug tested first, or anybody who works as a lobbyist has to be drug tested first?
The comparison
legislators have to pee in the cup every morning when they show up for work?
Well, maybe legislators is a good comparison. The other two weren't particularly great comparisons. The question is whether the government is giving money, welfare, should we have to, the American people have to give money to those who are on drugs. I don't think it's a natural right that the that those who take drugs should be able to get money or deserve money from the government. I don't think that's a natural born right that they have.
So I think you're saying that if somebody is poor and they're suffering from the disease of drug addiction, to hell with them. We're going to make their life even more miserable, and we're not going to treat them.
Well, actually, in the example that you're citing, Tom, I'm not exactly sure why you're upset with Ohio. Ohio, it doesn't even seem to be a case where they're doing this for fiscal reasons. They're doing this to, according to the law, the legislation, from what I can tell, is to help people get off of drugs. They have set aside money.
Well, that's because they were shamed into it, Jamie. When the original law was proposed, it was a clone of the Florida law.
That's what it is now. But so if it was changed,
it still carries that stigma. It still says, oh, you want some welfare benefits, you're going to have to pee in the cup. What happened to our saying, we are so great a country, we are so rich a country, we are so noble a country that we don't want to have pockets of horrible grinding poverty in this country. We're not going to, there's a certain net that we're not going to let people fall through.
And we I don't think it is, again, a natural born right which that says that if you are in poverty and you're doing drugs at the same time, that the government needs to subsidize that. I don't think that the government has an obligation to subsidize that. And I think it's the right of states, should they decide it's cost effective, to drug test people. Now, again, in this Ohio bill, Tom.
But you're talking about forcing everybody who's getting benefits.
In this Ohio bill. It's actually, from what I can tell, has nothing to do with economic matters at this point. It's basically to try to wean people off drugs. You said, this disease, do you want to hurt people with this disease of drug abuse? Well, in Ohio, what the legislation is designed to do, I just don't understand why you oppose it. This is something that would seem to be
allowed. If the Republicans in Ohio are so committed to helping people who are drug abusers, why not have everybody in the state be forced to pee into a cup?
Because they don't have, that would be kind of, I think, overstepping their bounds of forcing everybody to do something. I don't think that would be even constitutional.
You ever been forced to take a drug test, Jamie?
No.
Okay.
I wouldn't mind it. I mean, I have no problem. People that
you have no problem with somebody following you into the bathroom once a month and watching you pee into a cup.
It would be a choice. If I were to work at the Daily Column and say, you can work here, but if you do, you have to take a drug test. And then I would have a choice whether I want to work at the Daily Caller, and subject myself to that. For instance, I am a huge boxing fan. I this weekend just watched Manny Pacquiao fight Juan Miguel Marquez. Both of them have to take drug tests, certainly after they fight.
Yeah, but they were not looking for recreational drugs. They were looking for performance enhancing steroids.
Actually, in the case, that's true, but it's also recreational drugs.
That's kind of thrown in after the fact.
Chavez,
you and I both know if it wasn't for steroids, there would be no drug testing.
Chavez Jr., one of the great boxers, the son of the legendary Chavez, recently had a major fight, and he had pot. He has found out that he had pot in his system, and he's been, I think, barred from Vegas fighting for a year.
Yeah, but as I said, that was basically added on. The whole drug test athletes thing was all about performance enhancing drugs. And then the drug testing industry got on board with this.
The point is, Jamie. The point is that if they think it's an invasion of their privacy to get drug tested, they have a choice. In the case of Manny Pacquiao and Juan Miguel Marquez, they can forgo millions of dollars that they can earn, or they can take the drug test. They chose to do it. This happens on a much smaller level here with people with the jobs they take. And in this case, in some cases, some states want to have welfare recipients
Why do you care?
I don't care that a welfare recipient might be smoking pot. I don't follow this issue very much. I'm for drug legalization. I don't have a moral problem with people taking drugs, but I don't think it's necessary that the government should subsidize it. I don't endorse doing drugs. I think it's a bad idea.
But Jamie, the position that you're taking is that your tax dollars and my tax dollars should be taken from us at gunpoint to pay to drug test somebody who's not earning an income.
Wrong. Our tax dollars are being taken from us
by force, and they're being used to pay for those drug tests.
Right. No, they're also being used to give to the welfare recipient.
Well, set that aside for a moment. Why would you want our tax dollars being used to drug test anybody who is not driving a car or operating dangerous equipment?
First of all, you're acting like I'm advocating this as a great policy proposal. I'm saying that if
And you are.
If I'm not, I'm saying if it makes sense on a state level for fiscal reasons, which there's evidence.
Which has never been demonstrated. In fact, in Florida, they found it didn't make sense.
And I'm not saying it has. I'm saying if it does, and there's evidence, as you suggested, doesn't, I think it's the state's right, well within their rights to do it. I have no moral objection to demanding people take drug tests before they get money from the state. So I have no moral objection to it. I'm not advocating it as a matter of good policy.
I'm telling you, Jamie, in my opinion, this is about two things. It's one about, you know, further demeaning people who are already down on their luck.
Well, actually,
and number two, you've got this industry that is very, very wealthy. They sell 15 cents worth of chemicals for $35.
Well, Tom, I can't imagine why you oppose the law in Ohio. It seems to only be trying to help people wean themselves off
because
drugs.
It only applies to people who are on welfare. If you want to find the people who are taking drugs and help them, drug test everybody in the state.
So it's giving a benefit to them. It's only helping those who are on welfare.
We'll leave it at that. Jamie Weinstein. Thank you, Jamie.
Thank you.
DailyCaller.com, by the way.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And check out Jamie's latest piece, New York Times, Cairo Bureau Chief, Muslim Brotherhood Moderate, regular old political force. We'll be back.
Last dance with Mary Jane, one more time to kill the pain.
Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. David in Ankeny, Iowa. David, you had some thoughts on drug testing.
Yeah, I just had one thought while you're discussing this, and thanks for taking my call, is if why don't we do what you said, drug test everybody, and then the ones that are working that come out positive, then they don't have to pay into workers' comp insurance because they can't collect it. Let's see how long the state wants to do that. Let's treat everybody fair and even like we're supposed to in this country, and then there won't be any unemployment or insurance for anybody, because we all know that there's a lot of people on drugs and they shouldn't have to pay for a benefit they're not getting.
Yeah, there you go. Thank you very much, David. Yeah. I see this as an incredibly profitable industry that's selling 5 cents worth of chemicals for $30 every single time, over and over and over again, making so much money that they can go into state houses and the federal legislature and legislate for more and more and more of this. So, Michael, in Grand Rapids, Michigan, you wanted to mention the DeVos family.
The DeVos family is how they pronounce it here. Yeah, I'm not sure. Tom, I wanted to call you, and the Michigan state of politics right now is just totally upside down. We got the Voss family, the Amway family, and then we got the Blackwater, the Princewater family. And there was a marriage between those two families of two of the siblings. So we got these two families here in Michigan, and the Republicans, with their influence, are just, I mean, it is so disgusting. Tom, I worked union my whole life, and when President Kennedy was elected, I was in high school, but the thing that stuck in my head is not what you can do for your country, don't ask what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. And by God, I've lived to that. That made an impact on me to the point where, yeah, I stop and I'll pick up trash. I will do whatever I can to help this country. And being a past union worker, I can honestly say to you, I worked years and years in the union, the best years of my working life. I retired at 62 with a bad back. I can't hardly pick up a quart of milk without it hurting. And I'm not complaining about that, Tom. What I want to say is I'm complaining about the mealy mouths who will denigrate us people who worked our butts off and worked our bodies until they're almost broken and can't hardly move. And they're telling me I don't deserve what I've paid into Social Security. I mean, it's just over the top. It's blowing my mind.
No, I got it.
And
not only that, the Republicans want to raise the Medicare eligibility age to 67. So, just keep on laying those bricks. Keep on, delivering those plates in the diner. Keep on whatever it may be. It's insane. Michael, I'm with you. Thank you very much for the call. Jerry in Three Oaks, Michigan. Hey, Jerry.
Hey, Tom.
You are a business owner, it says here.
Yes, yeah, I've been self-employed, owned my own business most of my life. I've got, right now, the company I own, we have about 77 employees.
Mm-hmm.
Always been big on providing good benefits for all our help. got a complete 401k, good, really good health care. And in the course, and I just wanted to talk to you for a minute about this union thing. Obviously, I might be one of the last people you'd think would want to call and talk about unions. But anyway, in the course of my work career here, I was the chairman of the local sewer board. And while I was chairman, I actually negotiated a union contract for the employees there. It was a very small group. Mm-hmm. Obviously, in that kind of business, you need really good health care. It's extremely important
right.
that you take good care of your health. And looking at what it was costing us, it was obvious that we'd saved approximately $400 per employee by going to a union, which provided the actual insurance through a third-party provider, which was Blue Cross Blue Shield of Michigan.
Right.
Now, I don't know how many unions are operating that way, and just I don't know that much about all of them, but let's assume that the majority of the larger unions do provide the health care for their union members, making them a substantial health group, a lot bigger and better than I could provide as a small company. Let's assume that they're doing that. Well, through a group like that, they're creating a really good rate, and I know they all have good health care programs. I think, as I think about this whole thing and think a little deeper into it, I'm not so sure that this isn't a case of those folks breaking the union to break the health care, because they could get away from paying what probably amounts to about $900 for a family per month.
Mm-hmm.
They could get it down to the $2,000 a year, like with a blink of an eye here.
Yeah, it could be, but you know, Obamacare over the next couple of years is going to take care of most of that. I think that James Hoffa was right when he said Michigan, you know, and Michigan's a heavily unionized state. 1 in 3 voters live in a union household, and the unions helped turn out the vote to help President Obama win that state by 9%. And therefore, they've got to take out the unions. I think that this had to do with politics. And that's what the president said yesterday. At first, when he said this has to do with politics, I was scratching my head. Thank you, Jerry, for the call.
Yeah.
Is the bottom line of what you're saying is, as a business owner, it actually saves you money to have a you can see where businesses actually save money by having unions?
Well, it certainly did in the case of that small municipality.
Yeah.
Now,
okay.
If I could get my company onto that same program, we could save thousands and thousands.
Yeah, amazing.
Our healthcare is about to drive us out of business.
Okay, Jerry, thank you very much for the call.
It is.
Thank you. And this is where, you know, yesterday when President Obama said, you know, he mentioned this is the right to work for less law, not actually right to work, but he also said this was political. And I was scratching my head wondering, it's political? You mean it has to do with power in the workplace? Arguably, that's political. And then it hit me. What he was saying is that the unions traditionally are allies of the Democratic Party, and that's why the Republicans want to take them down. It's the same thing as if the Democrats said, you know what we're going to do? We're going to ban billionaires, which is something I think we should do. We should say nobody in this country, you know, $1 billion is plenty. Nobody in this country should have more than $1 billion in wealth. Anything above that, we're going to confiscate it. I can hear conservative heads exploding all over the country. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
But how would banning billionaires be different, you know, because they're the natural constituents of the Republicans, be different from saying we're going to nuke the unions because they're the natural constituent of the Democrats?
I'm spending Hanukkah in Santa Monica, wearing sandals, lighting candles by the sea. I spent Shavuos in East St. Louis, a charming spot, but clearly not the spot.
Happy Hanukkah. Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. I just noticed a week from Friday is December 21st. You know, I know over in the Drudges sphere and some of the other wackospheres that they're all hysterical about December 21st. It's the end of the Mayan calendar, in theory, according to somebody, and therefore might be the end of the world. Maybe we should have like a going away party next Friday, you know, a week from Friday. See you, world. It's like, yeah, everything must go. Good one, Shano. Amazing. Rachel in Port Huron, Michigan. Hey, Rachel, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. Thanks for listening.
I'm just on my way back from the Capitol in Lansing, and I have to say that today is a dark day for so-called democracy in Michigan.
Yeah.
I can't believe... Oh, go ahead.
Well, I absolutely agree. I'm curious, what was the mood? Do people feel like they still have a chance if they show up in large enough numbers and this is really a protest, or was it more like a wake?
Well, there was a mix, because we did learn that the House did end up passing this out, and so it probably most likely will be signed by the governor tomorrow. However, I believe that today can be the first day of the 2014 election.
I think so,
you know,
too.
We can either crawl into bed and pull the covers over our head, or we can educate, reach out to our family, to our friends, and mobilize to take back the House, the Senate, and the governor's office.
Yeah, that's why I keep saying that what keeps coming back to me is that this action by Rick Snyder in Michigan, by the Republicans in Michigan. I mean, it's not just the governor who did it. He had the complicity of the Republicans in the House and Senate. And certainly, you know, was funded by the billionaires, the DeVos family and the Koch brothers. That this was the Todd Akin moment. This was for Rick Snyder. Todd Akin was all full of himself and thought he had it all figured out about abortion and rape. And what America figured out was that the guy was crazy. And here you got Rick Snyder saying, oh, this is the best thing for workers, when every study shows that right to work for less states, workers make on average $5,000 a year less. They have higher rates of workplace accidents, higher rates of workplace deaths, and about 30% fewer benefits. And so this is not rocket science. The governor lied to the people when he said that it was good for the people. And I am very hopeful, Rachel, that this is that moment. So anyway, thank you for the call, and thanks for showing up in Lansing. Good on you. Eric in Middletown, New York. Hey, Eric. You wanted to share some thoughts on drug testing.
Yeah. Actually, if you bear with me a sec, too, there's several problems with this proposed policy, you know, state to state to state, and then as they're apparently practicing it in Florida. You referenced, you know, the $30 test in Florida. First and foremost, any test that's being done at the $30 level in this day and age is not any kind of reliable test. So the folks that are going to fall victim to that test are going to be numerous. They're you know, famously unreliable.
Yeah.
And then the second problem, of course, is the spectrum of people they're looking to do this to. They are precisely the people who are in no position to defend themselves legally, scientifically, that sort of thing. And
right.
I experienced this directly and was able to survive it in a prosecutorial setting as a probation officer many, many years ago. And I had done my own testing and proved their testing was bad. And it was, as you know, like the Florida thing.
You were a probation officer and you had to drug test, or
no,
you
no, no,
were
I
on
was
probation?
I was a probationer.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I was a probationer, and what got me there in the first place was, you know, America's little dirty little war on drugs and its many, many failed prohibitionist policies.
Yep.
So, no one was deprived of, you know.
Yeah, I would say in this day and age when, and this is something that I should have brought up in the debate with Jamie, where if you eat a poppy seed muffin from fill in the blank, from Dunkin' Donuts or something, you're going to test positive for opiates.
But that's a legitimate false positive. You know, like with Mr. Akin, with Rick, and now Michigan is dealing with the subject of legitimate union busting or not.
Right.
On the subject of the poppy seed thing, a legitimate proper test would reveal ultimately that it was a true false positive, and they would know the innocence of the specimen giver.
Right.
But if they're doing the cheapo test, they, you know, do not pass go straight to prosecution, denial of benefits, loss of employment, loss of future employment, loss of, certification and licensure for all kinds of things. So,
right.
The testing has to be of a quality, and I'm litigating over it. I've called before, I've mentioned it to you in another context, but I'm in the fifth year of this thing, and I'm still nowhere near trial. My opponent is a major multinational, multi-billion-dollar corporation, and
that makes the drug test
pressure. Yeah, yeah, well, they're not the manufacturer of the kit. They are the background screening company that performs the service, and that's another problem. The state who's going to do the testing for social services agencies, whichever state it is not going to be the actual tester. They're going to contract it out, and there are market forces, price pressures, that are going to see that the cheapest test be done. And there's a direct correlation. You know, the price of the test goes down, the reliability of it goes right with it. So
amazing point. Excellent point. Eric, thank you for calling and making it. That's brilliant. Steve in Haymarket, Virginia. Hey, Steve, you think it's no big deal to pee in a cup?
No. I was in business till 93, and, of course, the IRS put me out of business, so I've had to go and get jobs in lots of places. So,
Let me ask you a question, Steve. Would you have any problem with the government coming in and inspecting your bedroom once a month?
Well, that's not a relevant question, but at any rate...
Well, your bedroom is less intimate than your body?
Well, the point is that you have to know, with being in business, you know, I actually know what I'm talking about. That, you know, you do have a responsibility. I had a loader that would go 40 miles an hour, and if the operator of that loader ran off and killed a bunch of people, I would be responsible for it.
You're not able to determine impairment by pretty much looking at somebody, by interacting with people? I mean,
I had 35 people working for me. I was furnishing 100% health care. In a lot of cases, I was paying the payments on their trucks.
Steve, if you're concerned about impairment, drug testing is the worst way to determine it, because small levels of drugs that will show up in drug tests have nothing to do with impairment whatsoever. In fact, tell me the last time, serious question, Steve, honest question. Tell me the last time you saw a news story about some guy who drove into the wrong lane of the highway, going the wrong way on the highway, plowed into a car and killed a family of five because he was high on pot.
It just happened here recently in Prince William County. They killed three nuns.
No, it ain't never happened.
It happened.
No, it happens with alcohol. In fact, in the states where medical marijuana becomes legal, what you see is a decrease in traffic accidents. Why is that? Okay. Because the people who are using medical marijuana were typically before using alcohol, and so. The impairment thresholds are different. How was Rush Limbaugh able to do his radio show and nobody realized he was high when he was taking, 200-300 milligrams of OxyContin, enough to kill five people, because over time he gradually built up a tolerance. If you've got truck drivers, you've got people using equipment, certainly with alcohol, impairment there's a fairly linear relationship and is pretty universal across people. Although a big man will be more difficult to impair than a small man or a small woman. But, simply because of liver size and things like that.
I had a guy worked for me that ran a dozer, and he'd come in every morning with a case of Miller, and he couldn't grade anything until about the middle of the day, drank a six pack, and then he'd grade like crazy. It actually enhanced his ability to do his job.
So you're making a strong argument against drug testing and in favor of an objective, that is, you looking at them, interacting with them, determining how they perform, an objective analysis of someone's behavior. I can see where, as the owner of a business, particularly if they're operating heavy or dangerous equipment, if you see somebody can't walk a straight line, can't speak a sentence without slurring their words, then the first thing you want to do is find out why. And if it's alcohol or if it's OxyContin, you want to know. Because that puts you and puts everybody else at risk, and you have legal liabilities. But somebody who the day before or the week before had smoked a joint, because pot stays in your bloodstream for, months, for weeks anyway, I guess, it can be detected. I don't represent myself as an expert on this. Six months, somebody said?
Kind of unnecessary, because it's
30 days.
Free market principles to control drugs, it would be over in a year.
In other words, legalize them.
Huh?
In other words, legalize them.
No.
Yeah, well, I'm not, you know, yeah, that's a whole different debate. I mean, I'm all in favor of drug decriminalization. I think we should be dealing with it as a medical issue, not as a criminal issue. But my point is that my two points are, one, if you're using drug testing to determine impairment, that's a dumb way to do it. There are easier impairment tests. Please walk this line. I mean, we've been doing this forever and ever. And secondly, that, you know, if you don't want, if you're so, you know, happy to have to pee in a cup, if you think that's no big deal, you know, what's the next step? If you want the government analyzing your body fluids, do you have a problem with the government coming into your bedroom and checking things out? That, you know, I think that we need to draw a line.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Frankly, and particularly just to say, you know, okay, I want to get some benefit from the government. What, is it next going to be for unemployment benefits or next for Social Security recipients?
Every time I read the news.
The news? Yes, let's read the news. Let's find out what's going on in the world with the Talk Radio News Service. Ellen Ratner will be with us. This Talk Radio News Service brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com. You can give a goat to help a rescued slave and receive a photo of your goat and the person you helped. And you may well see Ellen Ratner holding your name in that photo because she actually goes over to Sudan and helps make this happen. This is something that she created. It's GoatsForTheOldGoat.com. Hey, Ellen.
A good Christmas gift it is. Okay,
indeed.
So
Hanukkah or anything
you want. House New Year's gift. House Speaker John Boehner, he, as you know, was on the floor today. He is claiming in his little speech, it wasn't very long, that the president actually did not give him any list of spending cuts. And the White House communications director is saying that's just nonsense. Of course we gave him a list of spending cuts. That has been part of what the president has done. But Speaker Boehner is saying he did not do that. And then Speaker Boehner said, well, the president wants to raise taxes on many small business owners. Well, wait a minute. I thought the president is trying to push that discharge petition to get the 200 people who are in $250,000 and under. Now, you know, small businesses can be 50, 75 more employees.
Yeah, there are small businesses, by the IRS's definition, pass-through companies, that are multi-billion-dollar operations. You know, a big chunk of what the Koch brothers do is a small business.
Right.
Arguably,
so, I mean,
Stephen Bechtel is running a small business.
And then he said, well, if we would do what the president wants, we would see red ink as far as we could possibly see. What?
Like we don't have that right now?
It's quite astounding. Then Nancy Pelosi got on and said, basically, well, the speaker, you know, it was very nice of him to address these issues, and we're glad about that. He said he's willing to make some changes, but it's really important that any changes he makes not hurt the middle class. It comes right down to this. That's what Nancy Pelosi said. Now, Harry Reid also said it will be very difficult to get this done before Christmas.
Which means it's going to be the last week of the year, or which means it's going to roll over into the next session?
I think it rolls over into next session. I don't think they come back between Christmas and New Year's. I'd be very surprised.
And John Boehner has purged some of the Tea Party crazies out of committee chair positions where they could block legislation House.
Yes.
So Boehner's going to come back with a more moderate House after the first of the year.
He's definitely going to come back with a more moderate House, and that's probably why everybody's slow-mowing it. It's not to anybody's advantage, I don't think, to get this done in terms of political advantage. I'm not talking about the people out there who, you know, are trying to do planning and that kind of stuff. I'm just saying, politically, Boehner doesn't have any advantage to doing that.
Well, my understanding is that the one group, if you set aside defense contractors, the one group who actually might get hurt by this thing is people on long-term unemployment, on federally funded unemployment. And that's something that would be very easily solved in the first week or two of January.
That's right. I think there's something like 3 million people that will lose their unemployment benefits by the first of the year and another million by April 1st.
Right. So they can fix that in a week. And that's not a large sum of money. I mean, we're talking trillions here that they're reaching for. And that's not even hundreds of billions. It's tens of billions, maybe not even tens of billions.
And if you can get the economy rolling, we added so many more jobs this last month.
You have fewer people on unemployment.
We might be able to really cut that out over a period of time.
Right. Yeah.
Okay, Leon Panetta was on his way. Well, he landed in Kuwait today. He told reporters that there's no new evidence that the Syrian regime is planning to move or use its weapons. He said, we continue to make it clear that they should not under any means make these chemical weapons and use them against their population. And so he said that the United States has been very clear with Syria on that. Meanwhile, Responsible Wealth, it's a group of Americans, and they are among the nation's wealthiest 5%. They said under Obama's proposal, it's a flat 45%. They're talking about the estate tax. It would be a graduated rate starting at 40%, over 4 million, then rising to 47 and 49% on larger fortunes to be determined. So they want to put a larger amount graduated.
They want to raise the estate tax.
They want to raise. These are people like Jimmy Carter, Warren Buffett, Bill Gates Sr., 30 American business leaders and others who are very wealthy.
Millionaires and billionaires.
That's right.
Wow. Wow. Good on them.
Yes, very good on them. Some other interesting news. Princeton Lyman, who is the ambassador to South Sudan, he's the ambassador at large, handles South Sudan. He is leaving the State Department. He's leaving that job. And he is going to Juba in South Sudan.
Mm-hmm.
As you know, that's where our goats are. That's in where you were.
Yeah.
And he's saying that the economic development and growth is very important, and the United States is willing to support. This is, they're very cagey.
Mm.
A full-fledged democracy that respects human rights and rule of law. This has to do with a journalist that was killed last week. Another person that was beaten up, another journalist that was detained and beaten up. And
by whom?
The government says they don't know, but some people say they do know.
Yeah.
And so this was Princeton Lyman's way of saying, hey, guys, we're going to support you, but you better toe the line in terms of taking care of press, all that kind of thing. Exactly. So also, Henry Waxman and Bobby Rush have called for a hearing on the rate of decarbonization and global warming. There was apparently a Price Waterhouse study that said that the rate they would need to reduce the rate in order to not affect huge climate change, 5.1% a year of carbonization, and they want to have hearings on that. They wrote a letter to the head of the committee on the House side, the Commerce Committee, Fred Upton. So far, no reaction. But
Fred Upton doesn't even believe in climate change.
Yeah, I mean, that's a big problem.
Yeah, it is.
To say the least.
It is.
To say the least. I don't know how much other time I have here.
You got about 30 seconds.
Okay. I guess the other interesting thing that's going on is there is seafood mislabeling in New York City. This was a report from Oceana. It's an advocacy organization. They say 39% of seafood sold in New York restaurants and grocery stores is mislabeled. They did DNA testing on this fish to find out what kind of fish it was.
So people are selling cheap fish as sole, as
right.
expensive fish.
Exactly.
You know,
exactly.
So you want the $35 sole or you want the $4 rockfish or something.
Right.
Well,
exactly.
You're going to get the rockfish no matter what
right.
it's called.
Right. You're getting the rockfish as sole
okay.
as sole.
Ellen Radner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by Goats for the Old Goat. Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. You know, Michigan isn't the only place where workers are getting screwed. Twinkie maker Hostess continues the process with its workers even now, even after this whole bankruptcy thing. The company is in the process of a complete liquidation, 18,000 union jobs set to vanish. But more troubling, these people could be losing their pensions. There's an article in the Wall Street Journal. And in this, the CEO of Hostess, Gregory Rayburn, basically admitted that his company essentially stole employee pension money and put it towards CEO and senior executive pay. I mean, while this isn't technically illegal, it's another sleazy theft by Hostess executives who paid themselves handsomely while running their company into the ground. Just last month, a judge agreed to let Hostess executives suck another $1.8 million out of the bankrupt company to pay bonuses to CEOs. If there's no way to recover the money for the Hostess pension funds for the workers, then guess who picks up the tab? You and me! Through the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, federal agency, they're going to have to foot the bill. Hostess shows us clearly what Bain-style predatory capitalism is all about. Big bucks for the very few rich executives, layoff and poverty for the workers in their communities. And don't mourn the loss of Hostess Brands. They'll be back. The company's currently negotiating with over 100 companies, or potential buyers. I'm guessing virtually all of them are companies, to bring back Twinkies and Wonder Bread and Ding Dongs. You know, they'll be back. So this story really has nothing to do with unions. What it has everything to do with is the new American economy, the post-Reagan American economy, the Enronization, the Bainization of the American economy. These two companies would not and could not have existed in the form that they did. Enron's no longer around, but you know, in their classic forms, had the Reagan presidency not happened the way it did. This is like the long-term consequences of what seemed at the time to be relatively small changes, just like this relatively small change in Michigan that Governor Rick Snyder is pushing through of making the seeming. I mean, they're presenting it as, oh, well, we're just giving the workers the right to decide whether or not they're going to pay union dues. This right to work for less legislation. I don't know. You know, it's got nothing to do with right to work, first of all. I mean, that's a phrase that was invented by a Frank Luntz type person way back in the day. I was astounded to hear James Hoffa use that phrase, right to work, rather than right to work for less. I mean, it should just be, you know, pounded into the brain of every single union person in America. It's right to work for less, as the president said yesterday. Got a clip of that, Shano? We don't. We should make that into a clip. Anyhow, in classic Enron style, back in 2005, Hostess sent out a letter saying that they'd had a real profitable quarter. Their stock jumps up. CEO Charles Sullivan. Some of the senior executives sold chunks of their stock. They're making out big. The workers are making a decent living. At that time, one of the Hostess workers, Mike Hummel, blogging his Blue Barnstormer over at Daily Kos, he noted that he was making $48,000 a year, a bit over the U.S. median household income, had insurance and a pension. That's cool. Then a few weeks later, in 2005, comes the letter saying, oops, all that profit had really just been an accounting error. The company was actually in trouble. Although the CEO and the top guys had all made a nice killing selling the stock when it was high and paying a maximum income tax on it of 15% because they used the capital gains loophole that Mitt Romney used to become a multimillionaire, they now want the workers to take a big pay cut. Almost as the oops letter became the justification for asking the workers to take a pay cut, which they agreed to, and his pay dropped from $48,000 a year in 2005. Or last year, excuse me. But every year, $3 an hour of his compensation showed up in the workers' pension fund instead of his paycheck year after year. And with 18,000-plus workers, that's a lot of money, millions. Then came this Bain-style takedown. In order to strip the company down to its individual brands and sell them off piece by piece, the company needed to bust the union. The union said no. So the company went to bankruptcy court, a method Bain and other vulture capitalists used to kill off unions. And in the meantime, the CEO and the senior executives are paying themselves handsome salaries and big bonuses. And where's all that money coming from? Back on August 12th, 2001, the employees got a letter, which Mike Hummel put up on the web, that said that the company was going to temporarily suspend payments to its pension funds. That would be the $3 an hour that this worker had negotiated as part of his compensation. Instead of paying it to him by putting it into his pension fund now, the company said they're going to put it in later. As the letter said, I want to be clear that this temporary suspension of payments to the pension fund will not affect your pension benefits. The workers believed management and kept on working. But it turned out, as we learned from that interview in today's Wall Street Journal, that the senior management wasn't just borrowing the pension funds, they were using them to fund ongoing operations, including big paychecks to the fat cats. Hostess CEO Gregory Rayburn wanted to make it clear that he wasn't around when that happened. He said, this is what he said in the Wall Street Journal, whatever the circumstances were, whatever those decisions were, I wasn't there. After all, Rayburn isn't a baker. He's a bankster. He's the owner of Kobe Partners, a company that tells corporations how to restructure. Think Mitt Romney. And he's going to make out very well on this. Bankruptcy court just okayed $1.8 million in Christmas bonuses for the new fat cats at Hostess. Ironically, if you borrow money to pay for your education, you can't get rid of that debt through bankruptcy. It's one of those great reforms of the bankruptcy law during the Bush era. But if you're a CEO or a buyout bankster and you borrow money from your employee's trust fund, your pension fund, to be able to cover your own paycheck and multimillion dollar bonuses, and then you take your company into bankruptcy, neither you nor the company have to pay those employees back even a single penny. Part of their pension is picked up by you and me, the taxpayers. The rest just lost. You know, there used to be a time here in the United States when business people had at least a modicum of ethics. Mostly it was because the majority of businesses were small, medium-sized, and locally owned, so the owners and managers had to look the employees in the eye. Or the unions were strong enough to keep the CEOs honest. Reagan put an end to both of those when he stopped enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act, wiping out most of America's small and medium-sized businesses, and when he kicked off the modern war on unions by firing the PATCO union strikers. And you can see the result every day in any shopping mall or downtown in America. What you used to see before Reagan, and by the way, what you see now, last, about 6, 8, 9 months ago, maybe a little longer, I went over to Sweden. In fact, we did our show from Sweden. We did our show from Iceland on the way over there. I spoke at a psychiatry conference on attention deficit disorder. And Louise and I are walking around downtown Stockholm. And earlier we've been walking around downtown Reykjavik, the capital of Iceland, Stockholm, Sweden. And I remember it was like, you know, I think it was the second day in Sweden. We were walking down the street and it just suddenly hit me. I turned to Louise and I said, I don't see any chains. I haven't seen a McDonald's. I haven't seen an Olive Garden. I haven't seen the equivalent of a Macy's. What I'm seeing are a whole bunch of small locally owned businesses. That's how America used to be. Until Reagan said, no. You know, what used to be in our malls were locally owned businesses, and now what do we have? Big chains, food, jewelry, clothing, you name it. It used to be the CEOs shared the pain. Not so much anymore. Now if the company's going down in flames, I mean, well, Lee Iacocca, for example, when Chrysler was in trouble, he took $1 a year as pay. Steve Jobs did the same thing when Apple was in trouble. Pretty much anybody who's ever started a small business knows what it's like to make payroll for workers while taking nothing themselves during the first couple of years of the company. I've done it over and over and over again in my life. But in today's post-Reagan, Bain model, American capitalism, there's never any risk for the CEO class. They're not entrepreneurs. They dump all that risk on their workers. Karl Marx said that capitalism contains within itself the seeds of its own destruction. If true, we might see the sprouts of those seeds right now in Michigan.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Because these corporations, I mean, you know, this is the whole corporate and billionaire excess, ranging from Hostess to the billionaire oligarchs, the Koch brothers, funding Rick Snyder. It's all the same thing. This show is sponsored in part by the Tom Hartman Store, with T-shirts and mugs and bags. Oh, my! All that and more at TomHartman.com. Click Store. And welcome back, Defending America from the Weapons of Mass Deception, the Tom Hartman Program here with you. And Judy in Brighton, Colorado, you had some thoughts on corporations having their very own union?
Yes. After listening to you, I've become very depressed. It seems very depressing.
I don't think so. I keep saying, I think this is a Todd Akin moment. I think that the Republicans are overreaching here. I think, as we went into the last election, there was, you know, $1 billion spent to make the average person think that Republicans really care about their Medicare and really care about their rights and really care about them. And now what are the Republicans doing? They're going tooth and nail. I mean, you know, John Boehner is taking it to the mat to fight for the top 2%, and he's willing to hold everybody else hostage. Americans are watching this. Rick Snyder in Michigan is saying, workers, you know, unions, we don't. You know, I think this is the moment. Hopefully, I believe that this is the moment. And by this moment, in the next couple of years, when Americans wake up to this scam that Republicans have been running on them since the 50s, trying to pretend that they're actually the party of the people when really they're the party of the plutocrats.
Well, what I meant by corporations have a union, and they pay dues into it. It's called the Chamber of Commerce.
You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right.
And I think that the union should frame this argument like that.
Yeah.
And CEOs and top executives and corporations do not work without a contract. And they have written into their contract bonuses and stock options.
Mm-hmm.
So why do they expect workers to work without a contract?
Yeah.
And the other thing about workers, of course, they need to look at Walmart and how they're treated because they don't have a union. And if workers opt out to not pay the union dues, this makes Bill O'Reilly correct in what he quoted, that people want something for nothing.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's always going to be some people who want something for nothing.
Yeah, I know.
And that's the tragedy, and that's why... I mean, there's always going to
that's
be some people...
That's why they're getting away with this.
Right. There's always going to be some people who will walk into a store and walk out with something stuffed in their pants, you know?
Right.
And that's why we have laws against it. And that's why, you know, you in Michigan, they had a law that said if you're a member of a union, you have to pay your union dues. Sorry, you're getting the benefit. You got to pay for it. It's just
right.
It's just reasonable.
So.
And because to do otherwise is the same thing as, you know, walking into a store and stuffing something in your pocket and walking out without paying for it. Judy, excellent point on the Chamber of Commerce and everything else. Thank you very much for the call. Michelle in Bolingbrook, Illinois. Hey, Michelle, what's on your mind today? You want to talk about testing people in Pennsylvania?
Actually, there's two things. One, I actually was denied employment one time. We had gone on vacation. I had gone through a series of tests before that, like the written test and everything for the employment. We went on vacation, came back. We went on vacation to a foreign country where they have like coffee shops and delicatessen like teas. And I guess they put something in the teas to give it a little bit of a kick. And when I came back and took my drug test, it came back positive for amphetamines for
really?
Drinking this tea whenever we were on vacation.
Wow.
So I was denied employment because of that, even though we had figured out what it was.
Yeah. There's a couple
the
of.
The other thing.
Yeah, go ahead. There's a couple of herbs.
The other thing. Was and I believe it's Altoona, Pennsylvania. The Altoona Hospital. There was an article not too long ago where they are not hiring people who smoke. And if you are a current employee and you are a smoker and you fail the nicotine test, you are required to quit smoking or face some sort of ramifications.
Hmm. Very interesting. Now that's it's a hospital. They're trying to set a good example and control their costs, but. B, nicotine addicts are one of the last easily discriminated against minorities. and that's a debate. You know, should that be or not? I could argue either side of that, although my instinct is to go with the hospital if they're paying for health insurance costs. But I don't know. Michelle, thank you for the call. That's not going to make Shano happy. Sorry, Shane. Jerry in Amityville, New York. Hey, Jerry, what's up?
Yeah, how you doing? Yeah, I guess with the drug testing of people who are smokers, whether or not they have nicotine in the system or not, I guess a lot also would depend upon whether we're talking about after-work smoking or on the job, which the hospital has a right to.
Hey, Jerry, I you know, I smoked from the time I was 13 until I was 22, There's no such thing if you're a serious smoker. There's no such thing as times when you smoke and times when you don't. And in fact, one of the ways I quit smoking was I decided that there was going to be times when I breathed fresh air, more and more and more I wanted to breathe fresh air, and finally my desire to breathe fresh air outweighed my desire to breathe nicotine.
Yeah, you have a point there. I gave up smoking long ago myself, but on drug testing welfare recipients, in addition to, I think, the caller, Eric, made some great points. But my own point would be this. One of the things you were discussing earlier with a caller from Free Speech TV, I think, first of all, we should drug test all the politicians who come up with these bad ideas. And secondly, there's a bigger issue involved here, as far as I'm concerned, because this drug testing of welfare recipients, to me, it's a part of this bigger issue, the whole demonization of welfare recipients that started with Ronald Reagan and this racist, stereotypical welfare queen image that he tried to create in people's minds. And yet, the poor people on welfare, the majority of them are just poor, jobless people who failed to qualify for unemployment benefits, and then they're not all drug users. And I find it ironic that this whole conversation is coming against the backdrop of Republicans wanting to means test Medicare and Social Security beneficiaries and eventually turn these earned benefit programs into social welfare programs for the poor. And I think we progressives need to push back against all this BS from the Republicans and not compromise with them on these issues. We need to defend all these programs like Medicare and Social Security against what the Republicans call structural changes, and we need to fight people like the governor of Florida, Rick Scott, who want, and other Republican governors who want all this drug testing of welfare recipients. Why don't we drug test Rick Scott and ask him again whether or not he's guilty or takes the Fifth Amendment on with respect to...
I think instead of drug testing Rick Scott, you need to do a psychological profile. You need to do a psychopath test. Jerry, thank you for the call. I agree with you. I think that this is all about degrading, demeaning, humiliating people so that conservatives can feel smug.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I mean, that's pretty blunt, but I don't know how else to say it. It just seems like that's, you know, hey, they're down. Let's kick them. And the very, very pirateticiously ugly, the good, Ed Asner. Last week, Fox so-called News' Sean Hannity attacked Asner for lending his voice to a California Federation of Teachers cartoon video on income inequality. Hannity called Asner a Hollywood liberal, along with some other not-so-nice things. Well, Asner has fired back at Hannity. On last night's episode of The Young Turks, Asner told Chuck Yeager that he was fine with Hannity calling him names. Asner also said he thought Hannity was behind on his rabies shots. Despite what Sean Hannity may think, income inequality is a huge issue in America today. Kudos for Ed for drawing attention to it and for standing up to the bullies at Fox so-called News. The bad. Matt Barber. Barber is the host of a Christian radio talk show. And so on yesterday's episode, he was talking about the so-called war on Christmas by atheist groups when he gave his take on the best way to deal with atheists. Here's what he had to say.
What do you do with a bully? If a bully keeps getting his way and intimidating kids on the playground and nobody stands up for themselves, then the bully is encouraged and emboldened and continues to bully more and more people. But when a little kid is being bullied and he turns around and punches the bully in the mouth, metaphorically speaking, of course, then the bully oftentimes has proven to be a paper tiger.
Well. Well, arguing the physical violence, although he did say metaphorically speaking, of course. Anyway, I'm sure that's what makes someone bully. And the very, very ugly Supreme Court Associate Justice Antonin Scalia. In a speech at Princeton University yesterday, Scalia stood by remarks he had previously made equating homosexuality with murder and bestiality. When asked by a student about the comments, Scalia remarked, "If we cannot have moral feelings against homosexuality, can we have it against murder? Can we have it against other things?" He went on to tell a student, "I'm surprised you're not persuaded." The fact that Scalia compared homosexuality to murder and bestiality is bad enough, but the fact that he had the audacity to stand by such ignorant and hateful comments, now that is very, very ugly. That's incredibly ugly. Okay, welcome back. Mark in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, you had some thoughts on union benefits and Obama phones?
Yeah, I was commenting how you said about the wanting something for nothing whenever there's a worker that's opting out of union dues.
Mm-hmm.
How is that any different than somebody getting a government subsidy that they did not pay anything to?
In other words, the Obama phones that Fox News is all hysterical about, that a few people are so poor that they can't afford a phone to dial 911 with, so, you know, we'll provide them with one.
Yes, or any other government subsidy that they have, but they don't pay taxes into.
Yeah. So
how is that any different?
I'm not sure I understand your argument. Are you saying benefits, in other words, negotiating a group of employees getting together and going to an employer and negotiating for health insurance as part of their pay, that's the same thing as somebody who's really, really poor being able to get a free telephone, a very limited service and usage, of course, but a free telephone to make emergency calls.
Or any other government subsidy that
Right, or you know, BP getting $1 billion a year from the federal government to not drill, you know, to keep oil in the ground, the oil depletion allowance.
Or GE being a or GE not paying any government taxes.
Yeah, GE not paying any taxes, yeah. Okay, or the
Koch
brothers. Or Mitt Romney paying, you know, taking advantage of the capital gains loophole, and instead of paying the 36% that everybody else would pay on $20 million in income, paying only 15%. So that's a...
A loophole whenever you're following the actual tax code.
No, that is a loophole. When you reorganize your income so that it comes to you in a way that is taxed at a different rate, that's a loophole. That's a 21% deduction or difference between what he did pay and what he should have paid. So, I'm not even sure I understand which side of this you're trying to argue, much less what the argument is.
I'm not trying to argue anything. I'm trying to get your clarification.
I think that there is, I think it should be fairly obvious, my opinion on this, that we need to have, and we always have had, George Washington, a social safety net through which people don't fall. George Washington was the first president to sign into law a bill which used taxpayer money. In this case, the taxes were all coming from tariffs, but we bought things, so we were paying for it. It was essentially a sales tax. They used taxpayer money to pay for a home, for a building here in Washington, D.C., to house, provide food, and provide medical care to poor and indigent people. George Washington was the first president to do that. That was, you know, it was clear to all the founders. You know, we're going to have a safety, we're going to have a net through which people can't fall. Now, that is a completely different thing than a group of workers voluntarily choosing to associate with each other, more than 51% of them saying, yes, we're going to form an association and call it a union, and then collectively going to their employer and saying, if you want us to continue doing this job, this is what we'd like to be paid for.
But I'm saying about the people who are opting out, because there are other workers in the labor force that are non-union. They're not the only people who are quote unquote workers.
So are you saying that the people in a right to work for less state who are working in a union shop but have chosen not to pay their union dues, even though the union is required by law to defend them, to represent them, and to negotiate on their behalf, that those freeloaders are the equivalent of welfare recipients? Is that your point?
Yes.
Okay. All right. You know, I still think that is slamming welfare recipients. There may be a few people who are abusing the welfare system. The numbers are very small. I mean, when you look at the cash welfare recipients in the state of Florida, when they went out to drug test all of them, it was 4,000 people. So, you know, out of millions and millions of people who live in Florida. So, first of all, it's not that many people. And secondly, I think that, you know, trashing somebody just because they're down on their luck is like, and it's bad form. It's a bad meme. It's a bad way of looking at things. We really very much. This is Mark. Thank you for the call. I mean, this is, you look at tribal societies, Aboriginal societies, Indigenous societies, or just good social democracies like Sweden or Iceland or Norway or Denmark or France. The bottom line is, we care for all of us. I am my brother's keeper. And my sister's keeper, and, you know, on and on. It's not something that's argued or debated. So, yeah, I do think that the people who take union benefits and don't pay union dues are freeloaders, but I don't think the people on welfare are freeloaders, by and large. There may be a few. And those few who are probably suffering from some form of mental illness. And we should be treating them. We should be, you know, we should be taking care of that. Marianne in Everett, Michigan. Hey, Marianne.
Oops, hang on.
Okay.
I had to take you off speaker. Sorry.
Thank you. That's quite all right.
Hi, Tom. Thank you very much for everything that you do. I think sometimes if it wasn't for free speech and Link TV and Current TV, the real word wouldn't be getting out there. My comment to you, though, was I was thinking today someone asked me what I wanted for Christmas, and I said, you know what I would really appreciate
is if all my friends and relatives would sit down and make a list of all their elected officials, you know, state representatives and federal representatives, the White House, that sort of thing, make a list or program it into their cell phone or their computer. And then once a day, starting after the first of the year, pick one of them and pick some topic that's relevant that they want, you know, their voice to be heard on, and email them, Twitter, phone call, whatever, so that there's more public input being put into the representatives' offices, so that maybe they'll sit up and take notice that people are paying a lot more attention than what they think.
Yeah, I'm with you 100%. That's why I end this show every day with "Get out there, get active, tag, you're it." And the broader, you know, members of Congress, Sam, who's on our program, he works on the TV show The Big Picture. He used to work in a congressman's office, and you know, you hear the stories. And they figure out who the people are who call every single day to offer their opinion versus the people who might call once a year. And the people who call once a year, they take a lot more seriously than the people who call every day. I mean, it's just a matter of, you know, you know that most people never call at all. And so if we can get a lot more people calling into and writing into and emailing into the offices of our state representative, our federal representatives, our state representatives, too, for that matter, it would be a really good thing. I'm with you, Marianne. Very well said. Thank you. Brian in Davenport, Iowa. Brian, got a minute to the break. It's all yours.
All right, Tom. Thanks. You know, your show is a great show. Hey, you know, on this welfare and drug testing, I just want to bring up that anybody that takes a government check, corporate welfare, farm subsidies, government programs, anybody who works for the government should have to. If you're going to make.
So let's start drug testing all the executives at Monsanto and at Cargill and at ADM, right?
Everybody. Okay. If they're getting government checks.
There you go. You know, if I wasn't opposed to drug testing, I'd agree with you. So, but excellent. You know, I get it that there's a certain level of irony or sarcasm in that, but, and I totally agree with it. Brian, well said. Thank you for the call. And thanks for listening to Sirius Satellite Radio. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And at TomHartman.com, we also have a newly updated iPhone iPad app that's been optimized for the new display on the iPad. It's really cool.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming to the USA.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you in Dearborn Heights, Michigan. Is it Zoe or Zoe?
It's Zoe, Tom.
Hey, Zoe.
How are you? Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, you're welcome.
I wanted to comment relative to Rick Snyder.
Your governor.
Yes. The snake. What he's done and what I'm seeing is like he's separating federal from county from private.
Mm-hmm.
Now, tomorrow when he has to go sign that bill and they have rank and file members picking him up and driving him, he should call Dick DeVos for a ride to work.
Ha! In other words, the state police officers who drive Governor Snyder to work every day are unionized.
That's right.
Now, didn't he carve out an exception in this law for the police to allow them to keep having their unions?
And the fire department, things that he needs.
Right. Right, but
so and so now that's how he separated them. So I mean, rank and file, you know, unions, they support one another. They should tomorrow call in sick with the flu,
mm-hmm.
and he can call Dick DeVos for a ride to work.
There you go. Yeah, the blue flu we used to call that back when the police unions would do strikes from time to time. Thanks a lot, Zoe. Great suggestion. Steve in Roswell, Georgia. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Good to hear Tom. Talk to you.
Thank you.
I was just going to comment about the guy I called in earlier talking about the people on welfare and the Obama phone.
Right.
I keep hearing that a lot here in the South. And unless my facts are wrong, I believe that originally started by Ronald Reagan.
Yeah, it started during the Reagan administration. I don't know that Ronald Reagan had anything to do with it.
And it continued on through Daddy Bush and Clinton, and then George Bush is the one who added cell phones to it.
Oh, really? I didn't know that, but somebody called here 2 months ago or something and said, you know, what about these Obama phones? And I'm like, what are you talking about? In fact, I was certain that they didn't exist. And then I went home that night and Googled the thing, and actually I DuckDuckGo'd it. I'm using DuckDuckGo now instead of Google. I think it's a better search engine. And what did I find?
What are you using now?
It's called DuckDuckGo. They don't track your usage. They don't sell your information to other people. They don't throw ads at you. It's a great little search engine.
I'll have to check it out.
Yeah, DuckDuckGo.com.
I kept hearing about the Obama phone. I thought, I need to find out about this. And I Googled it and I Wikipedia'd it, and that's where I found out that George is actually the one who included or added the cell phones to it, not Obama.
Don't tell anybody over at Fox News, because they got this thing and they're hanging on to it. They're really upset about it. So, Steve, thanks a lot for the call. Thanks for the heads up on that. Paul in Woodinville, Washington.
Hi, Tom.
You were born and raised in Michigan?
I was going to talk about the right-to-work stuff in Michigan, but I decided there's been enough, and I wanted to comment on the Supreme Court and Antonin Scalia comparing same-sex marriage to murder.
Mm-hmm.
A marriage is a consensual thing. A murder, presumably, is not.
At least by one party.
Bestiality, at least as far as the animal's concerned.
Right.
But let me point out something about marriage and the definition that people, I don't think, really know. Marriage was defined by the Church, what is now called the Catholic Church, in 1215, the same year that the Magna Carta was signed. Up until that time, marriage was a secular arrangement. There was no priest or rabbi or anything involved with that. In fact, all people had to do was to agree to be married. In 1215, the Church held what was called the Fourth Lateran Council. Like we had Vatican II here, mm-hmm. The Church in 1215 had the Lateran Council was Lateran IV.
I'm listening.
Defined in canons 50 through 52 what marriage was and sanctified by God according to the Church, and it also defined who you could marry. And this is where they came up with the so-called seven degrees of separation, which went beyond bloodlines. It actually is why you supposedly can't marry your stepsister, even though there's no blood relationship.
Well, if you want to go back beyond that, I mean, Betty Bowers has this great video, BettyBowers.com. Betty Bowers explains biblical marriage made easy for conservatives, and I strongly recommend you check it out. But she points out that, first of all, there's man and woman, and this is in the Bible, Genesis 2:24. And then there's a man and women, which is in Genesis 4:19. Esau had several wives. Solomon had 700. And then there's a man and the brother's widow. This is called the levirate marriage. That's Genesis 38:6-10. You marry your brother's wife if she dies, even if you're already married. And then there's the man and the wife and his concubines. That's in Genesis 2:20, Judges 19:1 through 30. Abraham had two concubines. Solomon had 300. Then there's the rapist and the victim. If you rape a woman, if a man raped a woman and she wasn't married, she would be forced to marry him. A man could rape any woman that he liked, and they would be considered married. The drawback for the man, of course, he could not divorce her. This is Deuteronomy 22 through 28. And then man plus woman's property, if she's infertile, she gives her slaves to her husband, and the female slaves become his property. And then there's male soldiers and prisoners of war as a form of marriage. That's in Deuteronomy 21 and Numbers 31. And then there's the male slave and female slave, which is in Exodus 21. These are the traditional forms of marriage, of biblical marriage.
Yeah. I could point out also in Lateran 4 in 1215, as you pointed out, that it says in Genesis that you should marry your brother's wife if he dies.
Right.
This would be disallowed. And the reason they had the 7 degrees of separation, which are basically because they weren't collecting enough money. When people kept inheritances in the family when they were marrying cousins and so on. And so the Church came up with these degrees of separation so that...
Because there was a tithe that was sort of like an inheritance tax, you mean?
Yeah.
That's amazing. Paul, thank you for the information. We got the smartest smartest listeners on earth. It's just that simple. Anyhow, coming up next on the Tom Hartman program, remember we told you how the right was up in arms about the Muslim Community Center being built near Ground Zero a couple of years ago? Well, guess what? They're back! We'll confront Reverend Bill Keller of LivePrayer.com, who says it turns out it really is a mosque. And we've all been duped, right? Plus the best of the rest of the news. And don't forget, democracy begins when you show up. Get out there, get active, tag, you're in. Let somebody know what you think about what's going on in Michigan, especially somebody in office. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.